All righty. Well, we're continuing our series on the Nazarene, looking at the life of Jesus, looking at experiences in his life that sort of shaped the ministry that he carried himself through up to the cross. And as we walk toward Easter, we're going to be looking at these different episodes in his life. And today, this morning, what I want to talk about is reputation. We're going to talk a little bit about reputation. I want you to think for a second. What did your mother, or maybe it was your grandparents, maybe it was your dad, whoever it was, maybe it was a teacher, what have they told you in your life, no matter how old or how young you might be, about building a good reputation? What are some of the things that they told you? Or maybe it wasn't that positive. Maybe it was more of a negative connection. Maybe it was how not to garner a bad reputation, right? I think we can all think of some lessons that we heard about do this or don't do this in order to make sure you have a good reputation, which is what you want, versus a bad reputation, right? I mean, there may be a few of us in here that wanted that bad reputation because, you know, it got the girls or something. But that mostly we're looking for a good reputation, right? So, you know, if you have a good reputation, what does that get for you? Get you respect, right? A good reputation gets you respect. It gets you trust. People trust you if you have a good reputation. And, you know, even sometimes if the situation calls for it, they're willing to follow you. They're going to listen to you. They're going to want to be around you, right? You're going to generally appeal to people if you have a good reputation. But if you have a bad reputation, what happens? They avoid you. Yeah, people don't really want to kind of be right. It kind of sparks the opposite sort of things. Contempt, right? People kind of hold you in a little bit of contempt, all right? They'll not trust you as much. Distrust is in there. And at best, if you have a bad reputation, most people are going to keep you at arm's length, right? Because they're going to disregard what you say, because if they don't, then what happens? They run the risk of doing what? Of ruining their own reputations. Right? That's the whole problem. See, reputations, one thing we know about them is they're really not up to us, are they? Reputations are in the eyes of our beholders. That's how we gain a reputation. I remember this, it reminds me of the story of some friends of mine from seminary way back in 2003. You met one of them. His name is Josh Brewer. He came and preached this past Christmas with us. He was one of them. Some of these guys that when we went to seminary, I was able to snag a nice little apartment for myself, but these guys all got together and they wanted to find the cheapest place possible that they could live in while they were going to seminary because they were spending all their money on seminary. And they found a house in Waco, Texas. This is before Chip and Joe got a hold of that city, okay? This would have been a house they would have got a hold of, but well before they ever got around there. There's a house on the corner of 15th Street and Blair, and if you know anything about that part of the city in Waco, and I'm betting you don't, it is not a great part of the city. It is a pretty run-down, dangerous area. A lot of arrests happen there, and they got this big white house on the corner there, and they got it because it was only $100 a month each for them for rent. So, score, right? Big old white house on the corner. Across the street, there was a crack house, and on the corner, there were all kinds of low lives and some bad folks that were around that area. But these seminary ministers in training, about five of them, moved in right there and got among them. And reputations collided, right? And at first it was a little rough because they saw the Baylor stickers on their cars. And so there were just people coming to the door all the time asking for something. I need this. Can you give me a ride here? Will you give me some money for this and that? And these guys didn't really know what to do. So they kind of got together and said, we got to be firm here. We got to take care of who we are. We got to be a light here. So they bought a whole bunch of bread and a whole bunch of bologna. And they bought a bunch of extra cups. And they said, we're not going to give them money, but we'll give them a sandwich if they want a sandwich. We'll give them water, all right? We'll drive them where they need to go within reason, and we'll never do it by ourselves. But so they were trying their best to have boundaries and have this sort of thing. And it got to the point where they became beloved in that neighborhood by all these people who would be arrested from different times, or these women that worked on the corner. They started to love these boys. And to the point where when new people would come down the street and they'd go up, they'd see the house, they'd see the Baylor stickers, they'd go knock on the door, right? There would be people on the corner across the street going, you're not going to get any money. They'll give you a sandwich, though. That was the reputation that these guys built in that neighborhood. And, you know, today that's what I want to talk about, reputations. Particularly, I want to talk about Jesus' reputation. In Luke chapter 7, Verse 18, there's a moment where John the Baptist, he sends some disciples to Jesus to ask if he really is the Messiah. Is he the one who was supposed to come? Because remember, John had devoted his entire life to Jesus. And so you would think that after what we talked about last week, the baptism moment and the heavens opening and the dove, that John would not have had any doubts. But John is human, just like you and I, and he has doubts, right? It's because he knew two things at this point. He knew that Jesus was gaining a bit of a reputation for himself. And he also knew that depending on who you asked about that reputation, Jesus either was or was not reflecting the promised Messiah that most people expected him to be. So he sends some disciples to clarify. And you know, Jesus is very gentle with that. He tells his disciples, you know, go back, tell John that the blind see, the deaf hear, the lame walk, the sick are healed. Go back and tell him that. Let him understand that I am embodying what the gospel is truly about. But then what's really interesting is if you look in chapter 7, verse 31, it sort of sparks a moment where Jesus decides he wants to speak a little bit on expectations as it relates to reputation. So this is what it says in Luke chapter 7, verse 31. He says, Jesus went on to say, to what then can I compare the people of this generation? What are they like? They're like children sitting in the marketplace and calling out to each other, we played the pipe for you, and you didn't dance. We sang a dirge, and you didn't cry. For John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and you say he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and you say here is a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of tax collectors and sinners. But wisdom is proved right by all her children. So Jesus recognizes something in this moment. He recognizes that you can be the second coming of Elijah, which is who John the Baptist essentially was. Or you could be the Son of God himself. But if you don't embody the specific expectations that people have for you, you're going to receive only distrust and suspicion and any number of excuses of why they just can't follow you. And so my question this morning for us to look at is, what happened? Where did this reputation of a glutton and a drunk and a friend of sinners, where did that come from? What had Jesus done to effect that kind of assumption about him? What about his ministry brought about that misunderstanding? That's what I want to dig into this morning. And there's a lot of places that we could go to in the life of Jesus to do that. There's a lot of stories, but there is one just a couple of chapters back, Luke chapter 5. That I want us to look at this morning, because I think this is sort of that moment in a microcosm. We see it all right there. So go to Luke 5, verse 27. Let's read this little story together here. Luke 5, 27. See where this comes from. After this, Jesus went out and saw a tax collector by the name of Levi sitting at his tax booth. Follow me, Jesus said to him. And Levi got up, left everything, and followed him. Then Levi held a great banquet for Jesus at his house, and a large crowd of tax collectors and others were eating with them. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law who belonged to their sect complained to his disciples, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" Jesus answered them, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, it's the sick. I've come to call the righteous. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." That's a story I think we can dig in on for just a second here this morning. Because remember, at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, right, as we've kind of looked at it the last couple of weeks, he traveled around Galilee, you know. He started gaining some followers. And it's important to note there at the end of verse 28, it's important to note that where it says that Levi got up and followed him, that is actually, I know this is nerdy, but hang with me, that is in the inceptive imperfect tense. Y'all know what that means, right? Oh, okay, I'll tell you. What it literally means is, and began to follow him. It's a process. That's what that word kind of means. So when Jesus said, follow me, it wasn't just this out of the blue a command from a stranger. It actually was an invitation from someone that these people had become more acquainted with over time. We're going to talk more about that next week when we look at the disciples and how Jesus called them. But the point is that Jesus had a way with people, didn't he? Jesus had a way with people, aside from the religious elite, you know, and the self-righteous, as we're going to see in this story. He put most people at ease, didn't he? You know, he was comfortable with them, and they were really comfortable with him. And the question is, why was this? Why was this? Why was Jesus able to be that way? Well, we know that Jesus had an occupation before he became a minister. What was it? A carpenter. That's the word that we get there in Scripture. Just like his father Joseph, he was a carpenter. Now, the Greek word there is tektonos. Tektonos. And it means several things. It means a builder. It means kind of a rough carpenter. We tend to think of Jesus having like his own shop and he's building boats and everything. This is more of someone who was a handyman. Someone who was sort of a jack of all trades. And one of the things that we know about tektonos back then is that they were itinerant. They didn't just work in their one little village. They went all over the place to different villages to help people out in different ways. So he may be going one place, you know, repairing the lintel on a door. He might be coming over to another town and doing some masonry work. Whatever it was. Sometimes he and a whole group of tektonos might be recruited to go and help build a whole city, right? Like the city Sepphoris, which was under reconstruction again while Jesus was growing up. So there's a chance that he would have gone all over the place helping people and doing that. And the way it worked back then, you didn't just go and do a real quick job. You had to go and take some time with him, which meant you stayed with the people who had invited you. So Jesus would have understood how to connect with people. He would have understood what it was like to spend time with them, to be a guest in their home, to sit at table with them and to fellowship and to have spiritual conversations when they presented themselves to them. And I'm sure he presented it a lot. He knew how to depend on people's hospitality for his livelihood. So Jesus' upbringing as a builder, as a tektonos, as a carpenter, have you ever realized that is what uniquely prepared him for the type of minister, for the type of teacher that he became? His familiarity with being an itinerant builder is what made him an itinerant minister. And it's what made him so deeply embracing the fellowship that he got from people. Which brings us to this story, right? We're going to look at it in three quick parts. So part one, party at the trader's house, okay? So what do we know about Levi? We know he's a tax collector. Now, I've talked a little before about tax collectors. But essentially what we got to know about tax collectors was they were considered sinners. Why? Because they were traitors. They were traitors. Basically, they had traded their relationship with their own people for riches from Rome. They would bid on these collection booths because if they could do that, they could then control all the taxes that were paid through that area. They would tax crops. They would tax things that were traveling from one place to another. They would collect all that. And not only would they tax it, they would raise those taxes and skim off the top. That was how tax collectors made their fortune. And if they made enough of a fortune, they could ascend all the way to a chief collector of a city. And that's what a wee little man named Zacchaeus did. But Levi is a tax collector, and he's sitting at a booth, and he is a traitor to his people. And yet, he has this encounter with Jesus. And in response to this completely unearned, unexpected acceptance that Jesus seems to give him, what does Levi do? Well, at some point, he throws a party. He throws a party for him, and this party is important for us to understand. We gotta think what this party was even like. So, what did that party look like? Let's talk about parties. What do you got to have at a party? Food. I knew we'd say that in Georgia, right? Food. So let's talk about the food. Ox and lamb roasted on a spit so that just the smell and the savoriness would just waft throughout the house and it would go out into the street. People could smell this amazing aromas that were going on from this house. Pistachios and walnuts soaked in honey. Olives and dates and the most expensive cheeses that Levi could get his hands on with his wealth and freshly baked bread with oil and spices and the finest wine. And am I making you hungry yet? Yeah, it would have been that kind of a banquet. That's the kind of stuff they would have had. But it's not, but what else do you need at a party? What? Entertainment, exactly, thank you. You got to have entertainment, and that's exactly what they had. Their flute and lyre players would go around and would play music. Sometimes there would be dancers or even acrobats who would perform before the main courses were brought out. And in some parties, those dancers would sometimes double as prostitutes. It's just how it worked back then in the first century. But then in addition to that, you also got to have a place to have the party. You got to have a house. And we got to understand a little something about these first century homes. I'm giving you a little diagram of a standard Roman home that's well known and that kind of served as a model for a lot of the homes were built around the end of the BC area into the first century. And the way it would work is there would be this sort of courtyard that was open because it all was about status and influence back then, especially for the wealthy, right? Status and influence was big, and parties were the barometers to kind of understand that. So rich people would build these homes that allowed them to display that status. So they'd have this sort of open courtyard that people could sort of come into, and maybe that smell would drive them in there. And then there would be this large dining area called a triclinium right in there that would be open out to that courtyard, so that you could see who was at table. You could see who the honored guests were of that party. So that way these people could display who they'd gotten to come to their party. So to be a guest at any kind of party like this, it sort of reflected your status and your reputation. And to be the honored guest, which is what Jesus was, that was the height of distinction. If you were the honored guest at a party, you had made it. And this wasn't just a pagan thing to do. Definitely pagan people did this and sinners. But we know that the Pharisees did this too. A couple chapters later, Jesus is going to be invited to the home of Simon the Pharisee for a dinner party as well. But see, as an employee of Rome, Levi is considered a traitor to his people. And so his friends that are going to show up at this party are going to be very much people that can befriend someone like him. So they're going to be other sinners of various types here. You're going to have fellow collectors. You're going to have rich people that are kind of irreligious. They could give a rip about what the real customs of Judaism need to be. They're making money. They're happy. You're going to have a lot of foreign merchants that they do business with that are going to be coming through there. You're going to, of course, have entertainers and possibly even some prostitutes and different people of that persuasion. And yet, despite Jesus having this reputation as a good, esteemed teacher and as a holy man, he accepts this invitation that Levi gives him because Levi is just overjoyed. He throws a party in Jesus' honor to celebrate that he's been found worthy in the eyes of this popular rabbi, this popular teacher. So by giving him attention, Jesus has given him a whole new lease on life. By coming and actually reclining at table in the triclinium, which is the way that dinner parties would have been, by being willing to be that close to Levi and his friends, he's given them a whole new chance, whole new lease on life. You know, my friends at that house in Waco, they there were a lot of people they started to get to know really well as they lived there year after year. And there were a lot of the men, and they were kind of over in the crack house, and then there were some of the women that worked on the corner. And there was one woman that they knew named Dee, because Dee was just a big talker. And if you saw Dee, and I met Dee, when I would go over to visit, Dee would talk your ear off, and you couldn't get inside because she was just telling you stories and all these things. And it was hard because the more they began to know these people, the more it was difficult to sit there and lay in bed at night. The way my friend Josh tells it, he'd sit there and lay in bed and he'd hear the sounds of cars pulling up and voices and business being transacted and car doors opening and closing and then driving off into the night. And it was hard to hear that. And one time they remember one night they heard an argument going on out in the street. And then they heard the sound of glass breaking. And so they ran outside to see what was going on. And everything was empty. Everybody was gone. But they heard the sound of water running. And they went around the side of the house. And they saw there was Dee with their hose cleaning blood out of her hair. What do you do? You don't even know what she might have. How do you help? But see, Dee was just that type of person that just loved them so much. And she would talk to them all the time, and they got to know her, and they got to understand the person underneath. And Drew, who is another friend of mine who lived there, he tells a story of one time they were running late, and they had to go to a test. And they had to get there in time because the professor, who I know very well, locks the door. So they were trying to get out of the house and get going. And they were going to their cars that morning, and who should be walking up the driveway but Dee? Hey guys, how's it going? How are you doing? Oh, let me tell you something. And they're trying to talk to her and be polite because they don't want to be rude, but they've got to get to that test. And so they're trying to kind of extricate themselves, and they can't. And finally, Drew just says, "Dee, I'm so sorry. We have got to go. We've got a test, and we cannot be late for it." Oh, okay, I know. You got to get going. I know about tests. You go on. And she starts to back away. And then Drew says, "I started to get in my car, and then I looked over at her." And he goes, "I don't know where it came from, but I know it came from somewhere deep inside me. I looked at her and I said, 'Hey, Dee.'" And Dee stopped and looked. And he said, "You know something? You look really beautiful today." Drew says her face just lit up, as if no one had ever told her that before. And just, it brightened like 4th of July. Drew had given her a whole lease on life. He couldn't even have understood how. That's what Jesus has done for Levi and his friends. Which brings us to verse 30, right? Because in addition to John the Baptist, Jesus has also been gaining a lot of followers. A lot of commoners are coming out to him. But who else is coming out? Who else has been curious about him? Well, the Pharisees and the religious elite and the teachers and all the people who sort of ascribe to that sect of Judaism. Very law-driven. And, you know, his teaching is a bit radical, but it's been intriguing to them, you know. And his miracles and his healings are controversial, but you can't argue with them. And yeah, he may be a commoner, and he may have a commoner's upbringing. You know, he may be a Mamzer, and he may just be a Tektonos. But it's clear that as we read the Gospels, some of those Pharisees, man, they really wanted to believe that Jesus was Messiah. They really wanted it to be the case. But time and again, what does Jesus do? He challenges them to confront their preconceived expectations about what Messiah should talk like and what Messiah should look like and what Messiah should act like. So they've been keeping a close eye on him. You know, they've been watching out for him. And this lavish party at the traitor's house with all his sinful friends, man, this is one of those shattered expectations that they're just not going to be able to get past. So it's likely that the Pharisees are in that courtyard, because they're probably not in there fellowshipping with them, but they're probably in the courtyard to keep an eye on it, to see what's Jesus doing in there as he's reclining in that triclinium at the table with Levi and his friends. And as he's enjoying himself and he's having fun with Levi and his friends, they catch hold of some of Jesus' disciples, and what do they say? "Hey, why do you eat and drink with sinners? Why do you eat and drink with sinners?" It's kind of an objection to not only the kind of rabbi that Jesus was sort of presenting himself to be, but it's also a reproof of those disciples that they would follow such a renegade who didn't do it the way you're supposed to do it. Why do you eat and drink with sinners? And that phrase, eat and drink, eating and drinking, that you'll see that throughout the Gospels. Go back, read through the Gospels, count how many times that pairing comes up. It doesn't just mean eating and drinking. It means fraternization. It means spending time with each other. It means an intimate relationship with people. And hospitality, as we know back in the first century, was a big deal. You were supposed to be able to welcome people into your home. That was a big, important thing as far as your reputation was concerned. But the Pharisees and the religious elite, they believed that you only extended that hospitality to other righteous people. Other people who were keeping themselves pure. Because remember, as we talked about last week, purity was of utmost importance. Right? You had to keep yourself unstained by the world. And so to fraternize and to be intimate with sinners, that was to make yourself impure. And there is nothing more intimate than sharing a meal around a table like that. And so a good Jew would only ever sit at table with other good Jews. The Pharisees, they see Jesus' fraternization. They see his time spent with these tax collectors and these sinful friends. They see this as a complete betrayal of his righteousness and of his authority as a teacher. How can he call himself a teacher if this is how he's going to act? And these are the people he's going to act about it with. Doesn't matter if he believes that they're sinners, if he is not keeping them at arm's length, if he's not calling out their sin, and he is not maintaining that righteous distance from their sin that you're supposed to maintain. Well, then he must also be a sinner. How could he not be? See, because for the Pharisees, righteousness and sinfulness, they weren't conditions of the heart. You knew it by behavior. You knew it by reputation. And they expected Jesus to be a religious teacher just like them, doing it the way they did it. And Jesus is clearly not. So it is no mystery who started that rumor that he's a glutton and a drunk. Is it? Let's look at part three. The last verses. Let's look at what Jesus had to say to that question. Because he asked that question and Jesus either overhears it or maybe one of his disciples comes and tells him. But rather than, you know, oh, excuse me for a second. Some people have a problem with me. Let me go outside. Hey, guys, let's come over here. Let's not bother anybody. No. He just makes it a part of their conversation. Right? That sounds just like something Jesus would do. And in addition to that, he picks a metaphor that is just going to stick with this lesson he wants to give. He likens righteousness and sinfulness to what? To health and sickness. That's essentially what he's doing here. And that actually makes sense because the Greek word for save is sozo, and it also means to heal. So it makes sense that he would put these together. So the question that we have to ask ourselves by what he says here in verse 31 is, what does that metaphor that Jesus chooses, what does that tell us about the way Jesus views our sin? By choosing that metaphor, what does that tell us about how he views our sin? And it's interesting when we think about our sin and other people's sin, who's healthy, who's not. When I think about, you know, other people's sinfulness, I'm quick to point out how they're making bad choices. You know, when I see someone sinful or maybe I see something on TV about that, I'm quick to say, oh man, you know, they're just rebelling in pride and they're rebelling in greed or lustful pursuits. Man, I just don't understand how they can't see what they're doing. It's wrong, how destructive it is. But then when it comes to my sin, if I do something wrong, if I have a little moment of rebellion, it's always a little moment, first of all, right? And it's just momentary weakness. That was just momentary weakness. That's just the state of my own brokenness, and I'm never going to be fully rid of it this side of heaven. You know, it's my fault, yeah, but it's completely understandable, my sin. But see, Jesus reminds us that all sin is sickness. All sin is sickness. It's the symptoms of an epidemic. And none of us are going to escape it. Sin is this chronic health condition, right? And there's only one treatment plan. Only, unfortunately, a lot of people are more than happy to admit that they don't need any help. You know, that they can get well on their own. And among those people, there are always going to be good, upstanding, religious folks who think that all they need to get over this sickness is just some impeccable morals and a good reputation. We're sick, folks. You're sick. I'm sick. We're sick. And are we willing to admit in our sickness that we need a doctor? You ever known someone who's sick and they're clearly sick and like, you need to go to the doctor? And they're like, nah, I'm fine. I just need to rest for a little bit. I'll be fine. And you're like, you need medicine. Seriously. There's people out there that are like that. And that's really what it boils down to, what this whole following Jesus thing boils down to, how it starts. It's surrendering to the doc. Right? It's recognizing that our self-centeredness and our selfishness and our pride and all the stuff that causes all the mistakes that we make, that these are chronic ailments and they need treatment from the only specialist in the entire world who knows how to treat them. You can either try to convince yourself that you're fine, you know, you can keep taking those over-the-counter self-help books or those confidence boosters to take care of those symptoms for you. Or you know what? You can finally admit, I'm sick. And I recognize there's only one specialist that can cure me, and I got to submit to his care plan. So Jesus is referring to the condition of people's hearts when he responds to this. He's not saying he hasn't come to call certain people. What he's saying is, I'm not going to be heard. I'm not here to call the self-righteous, those people who are unable to admit that they've got it wrong, that they're sick. I'm here for the people who know they're sick. Because remember, Scripture tells us that there is no one righteous, not even one. Take a look at what it says. Oh, this is Romans 1. That's the wrong thing. Romans 3, I'll read it, says this. As it is written, there's no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. So the Pharisees might think they've got it together, but they don't. And you know what? This day and age, there's plenty of Pharisees out there who are going to lie to themselves about their health and admit that they've got it together rather than admit that they're just as sick as everyone else. And you know, that's a sad, ironic moment where these Pharisees confront Jesus because they're disgusted about how their behavior, how his behavior affects his reputation as a teacher, you know? Their concerns for their own neatly manicured reputations are such that it prevents them from seeing the true wonder of the gospel. That's the sad part of this whole story. They're so focused on how Jesus has failed their expectations of him that they miss the fact that God's love defies expectation. So what does this mean for us? What is this story? What can we take away today? Well, I think there's two questions that we can finish by asking ourselves today. Question number one, what's your reputation? Question number one is, what's your reputation? Are you known for some things and not for others? Think about it. When your friends, or I'll even think about it from my perspective, when my friends or the church staff or my neighbors think of me, what do they think of? Do they think of me as, you know, a good man? Do they think of me as an honest man? Do they think of me with respect? Am I a hard worker in their eyes? Am I faithful? Am I devout? You know, am I an example? Am I a churchgoer in their eyes? That's great if I am. But you could have said the same thing about all the Pharisees back then. What about loving? What about full of grace? What about merciful? What about kind to everyone, no matter who they might be or what they might be carrying around with them? What about joyful? That's one that's hard for me today. I don't know about you, but joy, that's hard to show outward. I can claim it in here, but I don't often show joy out there. Sometimes it has to do with the kids. But you know what? Other times, I'm kind of ashamed at how little joy I show. And the church used to be known for that. It used to infuriate the Roman leaders. The early church was just so joyful. What do these poor commoners have to be joyful about? But 2,000 years later, we're not really known for our joy, are we? Now, normally what we're known for is a lack of it, as far as people can tell. Or the fact that when it comes to sharing the joy that we profess we have, we don't often share that with the rest of the world. Whatever happened to our joy? The second question is, what's it worth? What's your reputation worth to you? See, we've talked about reputations today, and in the face of all those who were trusting in their own sterling reputations, Jesus was willing to sacrifice his own reputation as this virtuous and moral teacher just so he could show mercy to those who already had despicable, irredeemable reputations. He was willing to just lay it all down, his entire own reputation. He was allowing his own reputation be attacked and trampled and just slandered for what? Just to show love to the unlovable. Would I do the same? Would you? Would you let it all go in a heartbeat? Everything you've built for yourself, the good name that you've made for yourself, if it meant reaching out to folks that some of the people you admire or respect wouldn't be caught dead reaching out to. You know? or listening to or inviting them to dinner or just being friends with them, if the opportunity arose, would you trade what others think of who you are just for that chance to show compassion or patience or mercy to someone you disagree with? Jesus didn't condone Levi's sin. Let's be very clear. He didn't condone it. He didn't condone the sins of his guests. But you know what? He didn't allow that sinfulness to prevent him from loving them in a very intimate and tangible way. He didn't keep him at arm's length. I don't know about you, but I'm really good at keeping clearly sinful people at arm's length from me. People that I'm afraid that if I get close to, it's going to create a wrong impression. I'm going to get a bad reputation for that. Their impurity is somehow going to rub off on me. But where does that get us? I wish I could say that I knew that Dee's life was totally changed. I wish I could say that she one day she went to church and she prayed a sinner's prayer, that she walked an aisle. That would be awesome. But honestly, truly, I and the rest of the guys who actually lived at that house, they don't know what happened to Dee. They know that over time she kind of disappeared from the corner. She wasn't there anymore. She'd come around every once in a while, but they certainly didn't see her out there all the time. Rumor had it that eventually she got herself a little apartment and she was going to a church. That was the rumor. And the way my friend Drew tells us is the last time they ever saw Dee was around Christmas time. And he actually called up my friend Josh, who was visiting his family. And he said, "Hey, you'll never guess who stopped by today." And Josh said, "Who?" He said, "Dee." "Oh, he's back, huh? What'd she want?" Drew said, "She didn't want anything." And he called to tell Josh that Dee had just come from buying a car. First car she'd ever owned. She had just come from the place to buy it to show it to them. Josh said, "Really?" And Drew said, "Yeah, man. And I'll tell you what, I went outside and looked at it. And I said, this is a piece of junk. It's awful." But he said, "I knew that she was proud of it. And I knew that she had gotten her own money together to buy it. And she was so happy." And she said, "Drew, look at this car I bought myself. I wanted you boys to be the first ones to see it." Gospel's about freedom. It's about new life. It's about second chances, and it's about third chances, and it's about 23rd chances. That's what the gospel is about. It's the only real hope for our society, and it has been given. It's been entrusted to you and to me, not to politicians, not to activists, not to Hollywood. It's been given to you and to me, but if we only ever talk about it in here and we don't embody it out there, we're never going to see anything change. We're never going to see true lives be transformed. If we only ever embody the love of Jesus, as our mission statement says, just to each other, and we just go on judging and maligning and turning up our noses at the sinners in our midst that we pass on the street or that we see on TV, we're never going to see people come to Jesus. We're never going to see the church grow and thrive like it could. If we only ever think of salvation as behavior and not about belief first, which is where it starts, which is where it has to start before any behavior can change. We have to be able to draw people in with the belief part of that. And if you were here this morning, and the gospel for you has always been about behavior, about cleaning up your act, I'm here to tell you this morning, it is not. It's about belief first. The Spirit's gonna work on your act. You just got to surrender to the doctor, to the great physician who's going to mend the inside. He's going to mend the brokenness. He's going to take away the sickness. And over time, those symptoms are going to go away. Not completely. If got to be about belief. Because if not, then we've just traded the message of salvation for a message of self-help. We've just traded the gospel of Jesus for a gospel of sin management. So what's your reputation worth to you, folks? What's it worth? Is it worth more than admitting that you're sick and in need of the great physician? I want to tell you this morning, this is your time. You got to let it go. You got to let it go. And if it's worth more than crossing an aisle and reaching out to those who you may disagree with in this bitterly divided country of ours, it's time to let it go. If your reputation is worth more to you than the real Jesus, the one who sacrificed everything, he gave up his career, he gave up his good name, he gave up his reputation, he gave up his life just so you could receive his mercy and be healed. It's worth more to you than that, well, then it's time to repent. I'd like you to bow your heads for a moment.